remember me from that movie about a mannequin that comes to life?
Get back.
Well, honey, it's happening again.
Mannequin 2, on the move.
Stranger things have happened.
Rated PG.
Welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated sequels. You know, the ones that some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello!
And I'm Claire. And welcome to our third season.
Yay!
Season three, Michael. This is so exciting.
I know, we've made it to 3 years and over 54 episodes now.
Something like that. Yes. Yes, we're celebrating, listeners. You will have noticed we've celebrated with a shiny new theme tune. Also, very exciting.
Seen the theme tune.
That was our little gift from Santa.
Yes, it was. It was a. I kind of like it. It's got that film 95 Barry Norman BBC kind of feel to it, and a little bit of. In England, we have this adverts that go before the movie, and they're produced by this company called Pearl and Dean. Is that right, Claire? Pearl and Dean.
Yeah, I have no idea who Pearl and Dean are, apart from.
They do this. They gather this information for the cinemas, but they have this really famous theme tune that.
Everyone in the UK knows that sting.
Yeah,
no one anywhere else knows that sting.
But if you got on holiday, you would know on vacation, you would know what that noise is. If you went to the movie theater, and we've always wanted to sound like that, and I think we've got it. I think we've got it because the first theme tune
we're getting there, aren't we?
But I feel like this new theme tune, I think, has a bit more character. And like I'm loving it. So, Claire, what are we here for today?
Wow. In this episode, we're breaking an ancient curse with the power of true love, the kind that only comes when you meet the enchanted and currently inanimate love of your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, who clearly got over his initial heartbreak to reproduce and establish your family line. Michael, what's the movie?
We're heading back to Philadelphia and to the world of retail in Prince & Company's department store to find another horned-up young 20-ish-old guy fooling around. I mean, falling in love with a plastic doll. Mm-hmm. I mean, mannequin. No, Claire, this is not a 90s porno. It's Mannequin 2 on the move. Is she moving anywhere? We don't know. Where's she going? We don't know. And do we really care? I'm just like, what's going on?
But you know what? When you just say that, I'm thinking, actually, what we have is what would be left of the 90s porno if they took out all the sex.
This is
all like the weak storyline that they weave in around the pornos to try and make them make sense.
Even the 80s dance routine in a 90s movie. That was like, I was like, are we in the late 80s? No, we're in the early 90s.
This is a very 80s movie from 1991.
Yes. So, Mannequin 2 opened on May the 17th, 1991. It went on to take $3.8 million against a budget of $13
million.
I feel whipped from the scars of that loss. Just under $10 million loss on this movie. And that's not even, you know, including publicity. And I'm just like...
Movie. All the marketing costs are up, aren't they?
It is.
Wow.
So just for content, the original movie was released on February the 13th, 1987, the day before Valentine's. Makes sense.
Oh, very romantic.
Very romantic. So I don't know why they decided the sequel to open in May. And that took $42.7 million against a budget of $7.9 million. So they increased the budget, changed the release window, and fucked us all over.
That's a massive return on that first movie.
Sure, back then, that was seen as a really
good movie of that type as well. Like,
yeah, good, healthy return. You know, you basically, if you make a movie, you want to roughly take 3 to 4 times the budget. To say, pat on the back, well done, that's really good.
Yeah. And what you said, 42 million from seven?
42.7 million against a budget of 7.9 million.
Yeah, so that's like over 5 times. That's solid. You can understand why they thought they could replicate that with a sequel.
Yes. Unfortunately, Mannequin 2 on the move ended its domestic box office run, finishing at number 150. for the year. So, didn't really perform that well. And the first movie finished in number 27 in the domestic box office. So that's quite a massive drop off, you know, 100 and something. Claire's favorite part of my information I give her, what I just read from the internet, but I say it every time, the 1991 box office worldwide. Yay! Think Claire go, oh, that's a good list. Listen, right. So at number 10, we have Naked Gun 2.5, The Smell of Fear.
Mm-hmm.
Number 9, Steve Martin's Father of the Bride.
Mm-hmm.
Number 8, When Everybody Worked for a Squill, Sleeping with the Enemy, one of Claire's favorites.
I do like that film.
Yeah. When I first met Claire, she constantly read the book. Why did you constantly read the book?
No, not constantly. It just took me a really long time. I don't think I ever finished it.
Oh, I thought you were just reading it.
It's not like I was reading it over and over and over. No. I just had the book. I found it in a charity shop. I was like, I've got the book of the movie. I love this movie. I'm looking at my bookshelf now. I might still have it. I can't see it, but maybe it's in there somewhere. I never finished it, so...
Oh, like that you wouldn't have time now to finish it, you Asprogs.
No.
Everything. No time for that stuff.
You're never going to read a book again.
Number 7, The Addams Family. Number 6, Hook. Number 5, City Slickers. Number 4, Silence of the Lambs. Number 3, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Number 2, Terminator 2, Judgment Day. And number 1, one of Claire's other favourite films of the early 90s, Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, that is a really good list. I think I like all the films on that list.
Yeah, they are. It's a good list. It's a really good list.
It's not often I've seen all of the films on the list that you give.
Yeah.
But that one I have seen all of them.
I think the other day, I really should re-watch Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves because I haven't seen that in years. I was like, does it have a 4K?
Oh, that gets quite a frequent rewatch in our house. It's one of my husband's favourites. But you do need a good chunk of time because he likes to watch the full version, which is like 2.5 hours.
I've never seen the full version.
Oh, I've got it on DVD. I'll bring it with next time I come over or next time you're over here.
I don't watch DVDs. Have you got it on 4K?
No. No. No, I don't.
Okay, maybe.
No, but it's good. Yeah, the full director's version is good, but it's long. It's like 2.5 hours.
Other memorable movies released that year are Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle 2, The Secret of the Ooze, Backdraft, Hot Shots, Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, Cape Fear, My Girl, JFK, Prince of Tides, Bill and Ted Bogus Journey, Soap Dish, Never Ending Story, Part 2. And another film that's a guilty pleasure of mine, Don't Tell Mum the Babysitter's Dead. Have you seen that film with Christina Applegate?
I think I have, yeah. I feel like I have. I couldn't tell you a thing about it, but that's fairly typical for me. So don't really know why I do a movie podcast. I've hardly seen any movies and I've forgotten most of the ones I've seen.
That's why it's half the fun of having these conversations, because you always seem surprised. If I spoke to somebody like me, they would be like, and... the most basic information, Claire's like, ooh, did you know?
Ooh, this is new information. Claire, you've seen that movie 15 times. Have I?
Slept through most of it. Mannequin Probably. 2 on the Move, it currently sits at 807 at the domestic sequel box office of all time, just behind The Curse of the Pink Panther. So Mannequin 2's Rotten Tomato scores 13% critics and 40% audience.
Okay. That doesn't surprise me a huge amount, to be honest.
No.
Critics are always a bit criticky about this sort of thing. And I was a bit, okay.
So, Claire, do you have any behind-the-scenes stuff for us?
I do. So, in terms of our cast and creative team, we have got 2 returning cast in this movie from the first one. We've got Meshach Taylor in back as Hollywood Montrose from the first movie. In the first movie, he was a window dresser. In the second movie, he's a visual merchandiser, I'm going to say. He's head of visual merchandising or something, don't they say? At the beginning, he's head of something anyway. And he's creating this production of presentation. Is that what he calls it?
Presentation?
Production?
Yeah.
Yes. Presentation about the mannequin. This is the whole concept for this movie. So he is back. He also has a minor second role in this movie, which is a little bit confusing. I think just because a lot of the main cast were doubled, because a lot of the principal cast of this movie had their present day version of the character they were playing, and then their historical time
1600s
version.
1600s kind of.
Yes, version of the character, the equivalent of that character from the sort of prologue of the movie, which of course Meshach Taylor does not appear in. So he only had one character to play. So I wonder if they went, well, everyone else gets two, so let's give him two. So we also see him as the bouncer at the nightclub that they go to for the big dance number scene. But it's a fairly blink and you'll miss it part. He's only in that one little scene. We also have Andrew Hill Newman back playing Andy Ackerman, who in this movie is the security guard.
Yeah.
In the previous movie, it's unclear whether it's the same character or not.
That's what I was wondering.
But in the first movie, he plays the janitor from the end of the movie when Kim Cattrall's mannequin is falling into the compactor and he goes to save her and he pulls her out and she comes to life and they're in love and yada, 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 smoochy kissing. And then the janitor, after everyone's gone off for their happy ending, then throws himself into the trash in the compactor room in the hope of finding another mannequin to bring to life.
Yeah.
Who will fall in love with him. So that actor is back as the security guard in this movie. It's not really made clear whether it's the same character or not, but my headcanon is that it's the same character because it was the first thing, as soon as he appeared on screen in this movie, the first thing I thought was, he was in that movie before. Yeah. I remembered him. I mean, part maybe because I watched them within a space of a couple of days, but it to me, it felt like in the intervening couple of years, he's worked his way up to a security guard position from having been janitor. That seems feasible, but it's not explicit. The character in the first movie doesn't have a name. He's referred to as compactor room janitor in the credits. So it could be a different character and they just loved the actor and brought him back. In terms of new cast, we've got Christy Swanson in as Jessie. Christy Swanson, best known probably as Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the movie that preceded the TV series. We've got William Ragsdale in as Jason Williamson, also doubling as Prince William in the prologue section.
Yep.
We've got Terry Kaiser as Count Spretzel, who is our de facto bad guy in this movie. He also doubles as the sorcerer in the prologue. We've got Stuart Pankin as Mr. James, who I believe does not have an equivalent in the prologue. I don't think he appears in that kind of pre-story scene. And we've got Cynthia Harris in as Jason's mom, and she also doubles as the queen. I think both versions of the queen. I think she is the prologue queen, the mum of the prince that falls in love with the mannequin. But I think she is also the queen when she briefly appears talking on the phone to Count Spretzel at some point during the movie. There's a conversation between the two of them on the phone, and I think it's her in that scene as well. The movie is directed by Stuart Raffle, who has quite a lot of directing credits on IMDb, but nothing that I am particularly familiar with. I don't know if you had a look at his credits, Michael, and saw anything that jumped out at you, but he has worked fairly extensively. So he's not a rookie director. He'd worked a lot before this movie and he's worked a lot since. But I guess his genre just hasn't hit my radar, maybe. I don't know. In terms of writing, there is a character credit for Edward Rogoff and Michael Gottlieb, who were writers on the first movie, because obviously there is that one character that carries through. And, you know, I mean, the basic concept is the same for both movies. Yep. So they would need to be credited for that. Edward Rogoff does write again on this movie, as well as having written the original Mannequin movie. He wrote Mr. Nanny in 1993 and Double Take in 1997. So not an extensive writing career. Co-writers also David Isaacs and Ken Levine, who are a writing partnership. They mostly worked on TV though. They wrote on MASH, they've written on Cheers, they've written on Frasier. So they're, you know, they are quite established writers, but again, not extensively in movies. And then there's also a writing credit for Betsy Israel, who has no other IMDb credits at all. So I don't know what her story is with that. But it's a relatively inexperienced movie writing team, perhaps it's fair to say.
Yeah.
And original music is by David McHugh, although this is the song is not his. They do reuse Starships Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now from the first movie. Makes its appearance at the end.
What kind of made the first film famous, I would assume, because it was...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it got Oscar nominated for Best Song from the first movie, obviously not from the second movie because it wasn't an original... original song the second time round. Yeah, I mean, it was a Billboard number one single in the States in April 1987, but it didn't get the Academy Award because the same year it also had I've Had the Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing. So it lost out to that.
I've had the time of my life and I've never felt this way before. Now you're not going to jump in.
And that's why it's normally me that sings when we talk about songs from movies.
Rude.
You guys all thought I was a shit singer, didn't you? In terms of production information for the movie, there isn't a great deal of information out there. We find this quite a lot with these sort of late 80s, early 90s movies that haven't achieved kind of mainstream popularity. Unless you can get into really... Yeah, but even the cult status ones, you have to be like top tier cult status for there to be extensive information available online. Because obviously at the time that the movie came out, there was no internet, there was no IMDb, there was no Wikipedia. There was nowhere for the geeks to kind of log all of their information about the movie. So it has to kind of have been a real top tier, either massive mainstream movie or a top tier cult classic for people to then bother to go back and retrospectively put that information online. But as you said, the first film was a huge financial success. And so Gladden Entertainment, who were the production company behind it, wanted to make a sequel. It's no big surprise there. You would, wouldn't you? The script already existed. I haven't managed to get to the bottom of where the script came from and how it came to already exist before the decision was made to make a sequel. Mm-hmm. It may be, given that Edward Rogoff, one of the original writers, was on board, it may be that he already had ideas for a sequel from the get-go and had kind of crafted an outline from that. That could be how they ended up with the script before anything else. But anyway, the script was already there. David Begelman, who had previously been head of MGM and was now head of Gladden Entertainment, he had worked with Stuart Raffel before on The Ice Pirates in 1984. So called him up and asked him to come and direct for Mannequin on the Move. Raffel's approach was very much to just play the humour of it. He regarded it as basically a sitcom, an extended sitcom. And so his job was to find the humour in all of the scenes. And that was kind of his direction that he was taking with it. I don't think he thought he was making any kind of big epic movie or anything. He knew what he was making. And I think he went with it. Interestingly, in 2010... there was talk from some Gladden Entertainment executives of a Mannequin remake. Now, I'm assuming they're talking about the original here rather than the whole kind of property as a sort of two-part franchise. They were going to modernise the concept by making it about a man who falls in love with a hologram. Now, I feel like we've kind of moved on in the world now that even that's not a particularly modern concept anymore. Bear in mind, this is like 2010, so we're 14 years ago, this was the idea. And obviously, we're 14 years later. There's no sign of this reboot. So I think possibly that's not going to happen. But there was talk of it, and it would be an interesting concept.
Still sounds like a porno.
Yeah, it does. It does a little bit. So, but that's all the information that I've been able to find on that particularly. There are some quite interesting interviews available online. I did find an interview with Stuart Raffel, which is where I sort of found the information about his approach to directing the movie very much as a kind of sitcom situation. But in terms of anything juicier than that, back sort of behind the scenes, there's not been much to find.
So before we move on, I've got to tell you about this book that's coming out in September called Comfort Sequels, The Psychology of Movie Sequels from the 80s and 90s, written by a therapist called Emily Marinelli. They even wrote a whole chapter on Mannequin 2 on the Move. I even got a chance to catch up with it. Would you like to listen to our conversation?
Of course I would, yes. Play the tape.
I I'm here with Emily Marinelli, therapist and author of Comfort Sequels. Thank you for coming on.
My goodness, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm very excited. I'm very excited for your book, and I'm so glad that you'll be able to join us today. I've been reading blurbs about it and stuff, and I've pre-ordered it. And
thank you.
I ordered it on Barnes & Noble. I hope that's okay.
That's wonderful. Yes, thank you.
I was like, where's the best place to pre-order it? We'll put all the links up on the website and stuff afterwards and all over socials. So hopefully everybody else will go off and pre-order it as well.
Thank you. That sounds great.
So, Em, tell us about your book and what it's all about.
Okay. Well, first of all, being on Unloved Sequels is the greatest place to be able to talk about my book, because my book is all about sequels that are yes, movie sequels specifically from the 80s and 90s. So the title of the book is Comfort Sequels, The Psychology of Movie Sequels from the 80s and 90s. And so in the way that what is comforting about movie sequels is all about what this book is about. And so for me, each chapter is devoted to a specific movie sequel, and I'm covering 12. And I have, 12 different ones, some of which you've covered, some of the ones you've covered on this podcast. And each chapter tells a little bit of my story, a little bit of memoir, and why that sequel is important to me in my life. Mm-hmm. And then it also delves into a little bit of a psychology of the movie sequel and of itself. And some of them also have celebrity interviews. So I have some interviews that I interviewed Steve Whitmore, who created Rizzo the Rat. In The Muppets.
Oh, wow.
I interviewed Christine Ebersole, who is a fabulous Broadway diva, and she was also in My Girl, too. So I have some different sort of, celebrity takes on the thing. But the book itself is about why we find sequels comforting. So what about them is familiar and containing? So for me, growing up as a queer kid in Oklahoma with, a childhood that wasn't great, where there was mental health issues in my family and addiction and trauma and things like that, I went to movie sequels to feel safe and comforted, because while there were so many things that were unpredictable going on around me, movie sequels were very predictable, right? These are characters who are coming back, maybe the same storyline that's recycled and, told in a little bit of a different way, but like something that's familiar and comforting and containing that you can literally press rewind and watch over and over and over again.
I feel like you're talking my language. I feel I'm in a therapist session with you right now, because I feel like she knows me. She sees me.
Same page, right?
I
feel like a lot of us might be drawn to sequels for those reasons. They give us more of the thing that makes us feel good. If you like Grease and you love the things in Grease, you just wait for Grease 2. I mean, Grease 2 is going to give you more and more and more. And even some of the characters are not always the same, but there's something that's familiar about going back to Right El High and familiar about seeing T-Birds and Pink Ladies again. And then we get like a totally different, almost on the verge of feminist story arc that's happening in Grease 2, right? Where it's like a reversal. And so there's these ways that it's the same but different, but more of the thing we love. And so the repetition of that can feel really comforting. And that's why my book is called Comfort Sequels. And it's what's comforting to me. It's not what's comforting to everybody. I mean, not everybody's going to be like, dream a little dream too. That's comforting to you. A straight to HBO movie with like Corey Feldman and Corey Haim is not going to be comforting to everybody. But for me, I loved it. I wore the sunglasses like they did. I was trying to do the MJ dance moves like Corey Feldman does. I mean, for me, I wanted to immerse myself in these movies and become a part of them and have parts of them that I get to take with me. Like I'm wearing a mood ring right now that always reminds me of Veda Sultanfuss. And I always think about My Girl too, and she loses the mood ring and then she gets it back and all this
stuff. I completely even forgot My Girl 2 existed.
Oh my gosh, Girl 2, it's got to be covered on Unloved Sequels. It's wonderful.
It's another, I think I'm still traumatized from My Girl, I think, from Paul Culkin.
And in that way, My Girl too, and I know that's not what we're here to talk about, but it's a softening of that first story that was so traumatic with Thomas J. And I think a lot of movie sequels are lighter and are softer. I think Mannequin 2 certainly is too. I mean, they're both silly things, but like Mannequin 2 takes it up even more. Yeah. Like the notches are higher in terms of the ridiculousness, the campiness, the early 90s nostalgia. Like it just goes over the top. And that's why I love it also, because it's like so filled with like frivolity and unapologetic, you know, ridiculousness. And I love that.
But what inspired you to, like, you've obviously had a great relationships with these guilty pleasures, shall we say. What inspired you to put them down in a book, though? Because it's like, for me, I know from trying to do the podcast, it's a very niche market, and it's not like a single genre that you can go out there and people that listen to horror podcasts or listen to, you know, like action podcasts about movies. We cover every genre, and your book is covering every genre. What's quite a hard ticket to sell.
It is. Well, I think when I wrote this article about and was able to interview Stu Pankin, who's in Mannequin 2 on the Move. You have to say Mannequin 2 on the Move.
Yeah, the whole title.
The whole title. And I even asked him, I said, why do you think it was called On the Move? And he was like, I don't really know. I think she was moving around a lot.
That mannequin moving everywhere.
She just keeps going everywhere. You know, when I interviewed him and wrote this article and started telling my story of how I first found Mannequin 2 and what it means to me, I thought, I want to do this with all the movies that are meaningful to me in my life. And when I think about them, most of them were sequels and are sequels to this day. You know, I rewatched Mannequin 2 to be able to speak about it with you, and it filled me with such great joy. I know every word. There's no reason for me to watch it again. But it still, like, you know, brings that childlike nostalgia and quality up in me. And I wanted to put that down. I wanted to represent that and also delve into a little bit about why that is and why it matters, why sequels matter to us, what they represent. I don't know that there's enough podcasts like yours or things that have been written about that specifically. And nice. I just wanted to have that because to me it's so meaningful, and I feel like to other people, and I think it is too.
Welcome to the family, and welcome to our little niche market. It's lovely to have you. It's a crazy world. Like even today I was in the shower and I was like, I really want to watch Batman and Robin. Now, most people don't watch that at all off the first time, but I get a raw gut feeling to watch it weekly. What's slightly worrying. I think it may be the point that I'm stuck in rural Vermont and I don't really have much attachment to the queer community. And maybe that little film makes me feel like I'm seen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, with Mannequin 2, for me as a young queer kid, I mean, obviously I'm not a Black gay man. Well, I don't know, listeners, I'm not a Black gay man. That's not how I identify.
I can confirm she's not a Black gay
man. I'm definitely not. But that seeing that level of queerness represented on film as a young queer kid with a burgeoning sexuality, seeing it at 9 years old in a movie theater in Florida, again, you know, living in Oklahoma, being in Florida, but seeing that representation of Meshach Taylor and as Hollywood Montrose meant something to me. You know, it was important to see. And then when I got a little bit older, I was, you know, what was available to us in terms of like queer movies for me as a young kid was really limited. And it was a lot of white cis gay male representation, which was also great and important. But to see Meshach Taylor just be over the top and to have that there for me was really important. And
how do you feel about his portrayal today? Not when we're talking about Hollywood. Because obviously he's a straight cis man.
He's a straight cis man.
And he's playing quite a camp, over-the-top gay man. And it's like, I remember watching Mannequin as a kid and I was like, oh, it's a gay man. That's really cool. And now I watch it and I'm like, oh, slight cringe.
I have slight cringe too, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but do you think if it was remade today, do you think that they would calm that down or slightly probably get a queer actor to play it?
I would hope so. I would hope that it would be calmed down and that, you know, I always want, you know, queer people to be playing queer people and to have authenticity of that representation. And at the same time, I really, at that age, really loved seeing that over-the-top queerness be represented in film that way. It meant it was meaningful to me, and it allowed for my kind of inner glitter to start coming out, you know, like as I would, you know... Because for me, what's comforting about some of these movie sequels is the way that I want to be immersed in the film. So I would, you know, what I did was like, what I would brush my teeth with Diet Coke, like Jason does at the beginning of the movie as he's driving. And the I was like, really, I know it's too far and it was disgusting, but I wanted to really be a part of it. I learned the dance sequence. Yeah. There's a lot of great montages in Mannequin 2, but the dance sequence when they're doing it at the club, I know all the choreography for that. Like I wanted full immersion into the movies. And so I had this kind of, inner glitter that needed to like be thrown out and about, and movies like Mannequin 2 and where there was representation helped me to be able to do that.
That even is beautiful.
To your point, that representation may not hold up today in the same way 30 plus years later and has some problematic aspects to it.
But I think it's also a generation thing, because I think you're from the same generation as me. And the, even looking back then, even the slight hint of representation to the queer community helped a lot. Now, if you show that to a Gen Z or someone who's a lot younger than us, they would be quite horrified by it.
You're right. Absolutely.
So you've mentioned a few times Mannequin 2, and obviously this is what the episode's all about. Now, in your interview you did with Mr. James, you also talked about your history with this movie. Can you give our listeners, not to stop them buying the book, but give them a little history about why you fell in love with this movie?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, you know, it was summer, a super hot, sweltering summer in Florida in 1991, right? When it came out, it's 91. And I'm 9 years old and I go to the movies to see it. I don't know. This is our family vacation. So I'm with my mom and my aunt and my cousins. And we go to see it and nobody thought it was going to be good. I mean, we all were expecting, we just wanted like an AC situation to be in there.
I've been in that situation in Florida. I can relate.
You just need to be in the AC, and we were tired and whatever. Everyone was sleepy. And it was one of the theaters with the dilapidated seats. And there actually wasn't air conditioning after all. So everything was like, there's gum under the seats that is just melting. I mean, it's like a terrible thing. No. So we try to have respite. We can't have respite, but we're going to stay. It's going to see Mannequin 2. And I expect to look over and see my mom and my aunt sound asleep. And I look over and they have like tears in their eyes from laughing so hard. And me and my cousins and I, we're all captivated by this film. Like we can't believe how good it is and how funny it is and how the timing is so great. And, you know, to this day, we say Mr. James's catchphrases, deplore, neglect, demand respect, make a show place of the workplace. Like we do that with each other through text and we talk to each other. And I think the biggest thing that we still joke about is Terry Kaiser's Count Spretzel's wart hair that they keep.
Stop. It made me gag.
It's so gross, but it's the funniest thing. And it just,
and how he's proud of it. That's what got me, was it's like,
oh yeah,
I've got friends that have moles as hair in them. I apologize any of you guys listening to this.
Yes.
The concept of that he's proud of it and he constantly strokes it really disturbed me a bit more than anything.
Yes.
Like, why are you proud of that? Just ignore it. Don't touch it.
He's so proud of it. It's really like a prop. It becomes a prop, you know. And so because of how long and exaggerated it is. I mean, it's again, the over the top, you know, and Stu was calling it broad comedy. That's part of the broad comedy too. The whole thing is campy, over the top. And I was mesmerized by it. I loved it so much. And we went back and we saw it again and we saw it again. For the rest of the trip, we just went back to see it.
Oh my God.
Thank you, Mom, for letting that happen, because that's all we wanted to do.
So you're the psychology part of the book. Do you cover it with every single film?
I do. And I pick a different aspect of the film to kind of talk about and deconstruct a little bit. So you mentioned Batman. In my Batman Returns chapter, I talk about this idea of a false self versus a true self. And sort of our false self is how we present to the world in a way that's not always in authentic. And our true self is our authentic selves. And I talk about that in terms of Catwoman and Penguin and Batman, how, you know, to the world, you would think like, oh, their false selves are their personas, right, as animals. Mm-hmm. But that's actually their true selves. So it's kind of a reverse. Because when you think about it, when you think about that party that Selena and Bruce go to, they're the only people who aren't in costume, because they go to a costume ball. I don't know if you remember that in Batman Returns.
Yes.
And they show up and they're just themselves because that's their costume. When they're in human form, they're actually in their false selves, and their true selves is when they're Catwoman and Batman. So I kind of explore those ideas and themes like that. you know, there's a my Ghostbusters 2 chapter, which Ghostbusters 2, it's so good.
It's amazing.
Podcast. So good. I interview someone who was in the film, who was hired by the studio to be kind of the Ghostbuster, who would go official Ghostbuster to go to Ghostbuster parties. And his name is Peter Mosen. He has a cameo in the film. And I also interview my cousin, who is a prop collector and artist, and they have all of these Ghostbuster objects. Yeah. And the psychology of Winnicott, who is a therapist, calls having a transitional object, an object that transitions you from the movie to the real world. And so when, like, if you think about kids, I'm sorry, I'm having a psychology moment.
I'm ripped. I wonder where this is going. Go ahead.
When you think about babies or kids, they want an object that takes them from the mom to the outside world. So that'd be like a pacifier, right? Or a blanket, yeah. Something you would take with you to transition you from the parent or the caregiver to the world. That's scary. So like, oh, I'm taking my blanket with me, or I'm going to take my teddy bear with me, or I'm going to take my things with me. I think that we do that with movies. I do that with movies. And I think that when we look at something like someone who's collecting props or figurines or toys, that's a thing, an object, Comic-Con, folks who dress up and go to conventions. That's something that transitions you from the movie. You can take it with you into the real world, right?
Making the lines between reality and non-reality a bit more fuzzier it's like a comfort thing. I do get that.
Exactly.
That's beautiful.
Exactly. It's like me having a My Little Pony lunchbox that I take to school with me. I miss the ponies. I can't watch the cartoon when I'm at school, but I can have the ponies with me during lunch. So I don't feel as like overwhelmed.
Do
at
you
lunch.
Still have a My Little Pony lunchbox now?
You know I do. And it's so cute. It's so cute.
I've got images of you trotting down the Bay Area with your little lunchbox.
I would too. I have no shame. I love it.
I'm fine with it. I think I've got so much Batman stuff. It's disgusting. It's
like, you do? So does some of that resonate for you then as like a collector? Do you feel like that transitions you? It you can take a part of those films with you and then have it around you and feel a certain way.
In my walkway in our house, I have two massive head statues of George Clooney's outfits from Batman and Robin. And they're made from the molds of his actual mask.
Genius.
And people walk in and go, oh, basically we're like, of all the movies, that one. And you're so proud. They're like, right as you walk in the front door, I'm like, and my husband's a massive Doctor Who fan, and we've got a full-size Dalek in the basement that you can sit in.
Oh my goodness.
So we encourage each other. This is a problem with queer relationships. There's no one to say no. When you're in a, you know, they usually get like a man or woman relationship, the woman will go, no, you can't have your toys out. And he's like, I'm sick of floral stuff, whatever they argue about. When you've got two gay men in a relationship, you just go, you want it? You should buy it. You definitely should buy that full-size Dalek. You want that hair to helmet? Yeah, buy it. You want this whole Lego Stormtrooper? You should buy it. It's terrible.
I totally relate to that and I fully support it. Like, get it. Get that in your hall, get that in your doorway, let it be. It's so, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's the immersion, right? We want to take that with us. There's something that feels comforting and it's a transitional object that transitions us from the movie into the real world, you know? Twin Peaks is my favorite TV show. I'm sitting in right now my room that is full of Twin Peaks art and books and all kinds of things. So there you go. It's just something that I think a lot of us probably do.
So you brought up Twin Peaks, and we can tell our audience that you also have a podcast.
Oh, thank you. I do. It's called the Twin Peaks Tattoo Podcast. And again, unusually specific interest that I have.
Tell me about that, because I looked at it and I was like, don't understand.
Basically, what I do is in the community, there's actually quite a few fans of Twin Peaks who have Twin Peaks tattoos. So I ask them about their tattoo. I have a bunch of them myself. Twin Peaks tattoos and other tattoos. And so we just have conversation. I ask them what it means to them, you know, why they chose that specific image. I ask them their relationship to Twin Peaks and what it means in their lives and just have really good conversation. So it was something that I thought might be an article, like the why that we get the tattoos of the thing that we love. And then I realized that, no, it needs to be a podcast so that people can share their stories. And it's been really amazing to do. So I'm just this year will be the third season.
That's awesome. As we go into the third season of Unloved Sequels, Claire is a massive Twin Peaks fan.
I have to talk to her. She's
really big. Because I was like, because I was going to say that, remember they did that weird Twin Peaks movie? And I had that written down as maybe we should cover it on the podcast.
Are you talking about Fire Walk With Me?
That's the one.
The prequel.
The prequel movie. And I was like, maybe we should cover that on the podcast. And I was like, do I need to watch the whole TV series? And she said, yes.
You have
and I said, am I in a mental place to watch it? And she went, no. And that was the end of the conversation.
Fair. That's fair. You really should be. Anybody really should be, because it's really heavy content. Yeah, especially the prequel film. So yes, but if you ever do.
Yes.
Please call me.
I will call you. Maybe you could just do it with Claire and I'll take a week off.
Yes. Okay.
That sounds like a great idea.
That would
idea.
Also work out. Yes.
So for the interview, and also you had published on another website, you interviewed our Mr. James from Mannequin 2. What was he like?
Yeah. Okay. Stu Pankin is literally, and I'm not even trying to say it for saying its sake, the sweetest, most loving and kind, gentle soul ever. He talked to me for like an hour. He's like the really sweet, loving uncle that you like probably didn't have but really wanted to have. You know, that's how I felt about him. He was really genuine and really had fond memories of filming Mannequin 2. It was in everywhere they filmed, that's where he grew up. So he talked about like going to the river, and he would go to Wanamaker's, the department store where they filmed Inside That Beautiful. He would go and meet up there with his friends. They would say, okay, we'll meet at the Eagle, and there's a big Eagle statue at the department store, and they would meet there and have lunch and like whatever, they did cute things. So he loved it. He loved being back filming it. And he shared that Stuart Raphael, who's the director, gave them a lot of artistic freedom to improv. So a lot of the scene where he's doing his video dating, which
yes,
is so,
it's so
weird.
Like, I suppose they put it in there to bring the relationship with what the mother did. And I think that was kind of like the linking the characters together.
That's right. That's right. But it was really funny. My name is Mr. You know, he's being really funny in that. And then when he finds out that it's Jason's house, and he starts banging he takes out the VHS and he starts banging it against the wall, and then he throws money at it. He improvised all of that. So there was a lot of spaciousness, he said, on set to just kind of play
so
and
cool.
do what they wanted to do. He also shared that the lines I mentioned earlier that are like family lore for me, deplore neglect, demand respect, make a show place of the workplace, that he improvised all of those. And then at the very end, there's that great payoff where he gets like shot at, punched in the nose and shot in the foot during the big presentation. And he says like, get a doctor on the, you know, and then they repeat it instead of get the doctor. So there's that big sort of arc payoff at the end of the movie.
Yes.
And again, that's all him. And I just couldn't believe those lines that we said in my family all the time were lines that he just came up with. I don't know. There was something
that's
just really special about that. And, you know, he's a big star. And I thought it was sort of funny that I was interviewing him about Mannequin 2 on the Move when he's like, you know, Earl Sinclair and Dinosaurs. And he's been in so many.
Oh, I loved him in Arachnophobia. Oh, my God.
Arachnophobia,
he was so good.
He's really good in that. I mean, he's just like an incredible actor who's been, you know, his credits are so long.
Do you know what? I've interviewed a few people, and I've interviewed a couple of film directors and also composers and stuff. And when you speak to them about their unappreciated work, I think they just, it's a chance for them not to repeat themselves. And I think for them, it's kind of like, I did this piece of work and no one's asked me about it.
I
spoke to Brian Levant about Flintstones in Viva Rock Vegas. And we spoke to like, in the end, we spoke to like for like 2 hours, because 2-3 hours, because he was just like, oh, I really appreciate all these questions, because no one ever asked me about this movie. They asked me about the first one, or they asked me about Beethoven, but they never asked me about this movie that was still nearly 2 years of my life. And I think to them, it's just like recognition that it's still being watched and appreciated by people, when it probably didn't do well at the time. But because once things now go to streaming and, you know, a home release, things get lost. And I think they don't get the feedback or the appreciation they deserve. It's one of the reasons me and Claire do this podcast, just to remind people of them.
I think that's right. I really resonate with that. And I think you're right. I felt that way interviewing Chris McDonald for the book. He was Goose in Grease 2. Yes. And he's, you know, he's got like, you know, he's in Hacks and all these huge things. And he was in Thelma and Louise. And he loved Grease 2. It was the first movie he ever did. And he just adores talking about it. I mean, if I just, we talked and talked and talked and talked. And he had so many stories to share. And I think for that reason, too, that he doesn't often get asked about Grease 2, even though there's a big cult following. And, you know, as you said in your episode, I think a big, you know, LGBTQ plus following too with Grease too. Yeah. But it was great to talk to him. I also interviewed Maxwell Caulfield, who had a lot of really cool things to say for the book, and also Leif Green, who played Davy Jaworski. So I have three T-Birds. And Davy's queer and out. And we kikied, and he showed me all of these. He showed me a gay parlor trick that you have to read the book, listeners, if you like Grease 2, which if you don't like Grease 2, you will after you read the book. But if you, especially if you like Grease 2, you're going to love Leif Green's gay parlor trick.
I can't wait.
So cool.
That's so exciting. Now, Mannequin 2 is one of your favorite films.
Absolutely.
Now, if you could change any part of that movie or any scene in that movie, is there anything that you would change? Because there's scenes in my favorite movies that I still go, I wish they didn't do that. So what is it and how would you change it?
I have thought about this so deeply.
Yeah.
And the answer is that I wouldn't want to change one thing about it.
That's okay.
I really wouldn't. The thing that popped into my head first was, ugh, why does it have to be such a damsel in distress sort of, you know, the men are saving her sort of storyline? But then even as I was thinking about it and rewatching it, you know, Jessie has a lot of agency over her own liberation. So she's like, you know, jump in the speed car. We're going to go home right now. And like, she's the one who takes this is all spoiler. So sorry. That's okay, right? I can spoil
it. Yes, you can spoil it. Spoil it as much as you like. Because if they haven't watched, if anybody listening to this hasn't watched a 30-year-old movie by now.
Yeah, too bad. She's the one who takes the necklace and puts it around Count Spretzel, turning him into a mannequin at the end. Yeah. So she's like, no, I'm, you know, and as he's, you know, being completely inappropriate with her in the hot air balloon, she's the one who then says, no, I'm not, no. And also then you're going to be the one who's going to be under the spell next. So she's kind of, she has a lot more agency than it appears. Could there be more sprinkled throughout? Yes. But also no, because the movie is so unapologetically, again, campy, ridiculous, over the top, all of the archetype, all of the personifications of things are over the top. So like, let's let it be all the glitter that it is. And those are my thoughts. But would you change something about Mannequin 2?
Well, see, before I moved to America, my job, I was a manager at a department store in London called Harrods. And I worked with a lot of people like Mr. James. So his character was very relatable to me because I had people like that you'd walk behind. It was like a military thing. And we had carnations in different colors, what meant what kind of level of management you were. So you had like a white carnation if you were lower and a red carnation if you were middle. And then you could wear something slightly different out of the uniform and be dressed how you want if you're above a carnation. And it had this whole hierarchy thing. It was exactly the same. The only thing I would really change in the film, I think, would probably be I would probably have taken it out of retail and putting it in a museum, because I think the fact that her mannequin is supposed to be this historical figure, and the department store I worked in was owned by Al-Fayed, who was Princess Diana's boyfriend's father. So it was all the royal family thing. So it was always over the top. We had Egyptian staircases that got listed as listed buildings and stuff that you couldn't touch now because they've been listed by historical artifacts, and it's the most ridiculous thing. There's a statue in the basement of Princess Diana and Dodi letting go a dove, and her ring with the ring that Dodi was supposed to give her before the accident. So it's the most over the top department store you could ever work with. And I used to manage there, and I was like, I never got a chance to do a dance routine.
It's never too late.
No, I don't think they'll take me back now. They're like, he's going to do a dance routine in the middle of the shop.
But I know, it was always completely confusing. why a department store in Philadelphia would care remotely about an enchanted peasant girl in the kingdom of Hotman Conic.
That's really... what got me. And I was a bit like, if they just put this in like the Natural History Museum in Chicago, that would make more sense. Keep the status
way more sense.
The same. And the fact that Hollywood is not really classed as a window dresser in it anymore. He's more of a physical display person. Like he's like a dresser. He could easily change those skills to dressing in museums. So his character still could have been in it.
Totally. That makes much more sense. But I'm thinking about it from a comfort sequel perspective, going back to Wanamaker's, where they were in the first movie.
That's when you mentioned that about Grease 2. I was like, yeah, she's right. It does make it more comfortable.
It's back to Rydell High, and we're back to Wanamaker's. And so we know that department store. We know that beautiful, gorgeous organ that's in the back, you know, that Kim Cattrall pretends to... No, Andrew McCarthy pretends to play at the beginning, in the first movie. But you're right, of course. What you're saying makes much more sense. Why she would be there.
Well, and also the studio would know the department store would say yes, probably because they got lots of publicity for it.
Very good point. Yes. Yes.
So and easy I still answer. Go
there. Yes. Okay. I want to make it there. I really do. I want to make it.
You could do the book launch there.
Oh, that's a really good idea.
They must have a book department. Mustn't they have
they
a book
must.
Department?
I bet. It's such a huge place.
Yeah.
I am having a book launch in San Francisco this year. The book comes out in September, and also probably one in Vermont. So I could be posted on all of that.
Yes, please do. I'll definitely come to some of them. You cover some great guilty pleasures in your book. Which one was the most fun to research?
The most fun to write was The Evening Star.
Right.
And it's, which is a sequel that if you, I don't think you've covered on Unloved Sequels.
No, we haven't.
And it's a sequel that really not very many people saw. And the people who did see it really didn't like it. But it's the sequel to Terms of Endearment.
Yes. Shirley MacLaine.
Yes, exactly. And it's a gorgeous film. And it was the most fun to write because I saw it with my grandmother. And there's so many intergenerational relationships in the movie between mother and daughter and grandmother that then translated really beautifully into me looking at the psychology of sort of mothers and narcissistic mothers and what happens generationally with that in my life and my world, but also psychologically speaking. And so that was the most enjoyable for me personally to write and to look at and to revisit in my own comfort sequel journey. I think that the movie that was, I mean, Mannequin 2 is like up there for sure. And Grease 2. I mean, I have so many interviews. Grease 2 is, the book is so Grease 2 heavy that it's like a whole thing. But I think I'm really enjoying learning about Ghostbusters 2 because talking to people who are Ghostbusters experts like Peter Mosen and my cousin Brian Johnson, I've learned so much about the franchise, the history, the ins and the outs of what was going on behind the scenes, how the different ways in which they used technology and props at the time and how it evolved, why Ghostbusters 2 wasn't loved as is a very unloved sequel.
I don't quite grasp it. Because I, as a child, watching them back to back today, you can see where you're coming from. But as a child, I preferred 2 over 1.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I was obsessed with that painting and the River of Slime. And I was, as looking at when I was a kid, I thought 2 was a better film than the first one was.
Absolutely. Yeah, but, same. But like learning about, the actor who played Vigo was actually like a wrestler and he was, or a boxer and, was like a really scary, scary man. And I'm laughing and I shouldn't be laughing, but and he was like the descendant of a Nazi and like just all this kind of history of that. And, I think why it was so unloved. One of the reasons I think it was so unloved is that it really had a big influence from the cartoon, from the real Ghostbusters cartoon. And so that was such a departure from the first film. And I think a lot of, in the fan community, I'm learning that folks were like, hey, you can't depart that far, which is why when you get Afterlife, Ghostbusters Afterlife, it really feels like you're going back to the first film. Afterlife to me feels like a sequel from the first movie.
Yes, it
and
does.
You sort of take out Ghostbusters 2 completely at that point. It's like irrelevant. It's like a whole other different story.
And Ghostbusters Answer Your Call, I try to shove that one in there and most fans go, no, it doesn't exist. And I'm like, right, why? Exactly. It's a great film.
But it's like, but right, exactly. They won't, in the community.
It.
Mm-mm.
I suppose it's kind of like I've going back to Batman. I go on a lot of Batman Facebook pages and stuff, and when all the fans did their drawing, they go, Adam West, Michael Keaton, Christian Bale, and I'm like, hang on, you've missed two. They do it all the time. It annoys me. And there's me. I go, should I be a keyboard warrior? And go, you missed two. And I go, no, don't.
But they matter to you. It's like what we know. What matters to us.
I think they probably matter to me because so many people don't like them, and I feel I feel like I should be a warrior for them.
It's not appreciated. And I've always felt that way about Mannequin too. I've always felt like first of all, people don't know it exists. But I've always been that like cheerleader champion, like Mannequin 2 on the Move is fantastic. Mm. And you don't need to see the first one. It doesn't matter. You know, it's the same thing. You know, Meshach Taylor says it, you know, Hollywood says it. This has happened before. I don't think you're crazy. This has happened before.
Wow. Just randomly talking to plastic people. That's fine.
And so, you know, I love being, I don't know if you feel this way, but I love being that cheerleader and that champion for these I Love sequels that I love so much and that provides so much comfort for me. And, you know, I think part of with Mannequin 2 in my talk with Sue Pankin, we talked about one of the reasons it matters so much is who I was with when I saw it. And I think some of these sequels, that's what it's about, is the nostalgia of sharing it with people and thinking back to those memories. And he shared, you know, going to see movies like Teacher's Pet and The Buccaneer with his dad, and how the movies themselves aren't really great movies, particularly Teacher's Pet. He says, you know, it's like a silly comedy and he wouldn't really care about it that much. Mm. But when he watches it again, he thinks about his dad and he remembers seeing it with him. And it really means a lot to him.
To have these memories.
To be taken back. Yeah. And I think so much of that could also be true with movie sequels.
Yeah. So thank you for coming on the podcast today. But before you go, we always like to ask our guests, do you have any suggestions for future episodes of any Unloved sequels you would like us to cover?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, The Evening Star. I don't know if anyone would want to hear about The Evening Star, but I have so much to say about The Evening Star, and I would love to hear about that. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze. Ooh. Absolutely.
That might be coming up this year. So
okay, I certainly
maybe you could come back.
I would love that.
So, when is the publication date for your book?
My book comes out September 2024, September this year. You can pre-order it. You could go to a website like Barnes & Noble, but the TuckerDSPress.com is where you can order it, TuckerDSPress.com. And it's also on Amazon and things like that too. But Tucker DS Press is the publisher. And you can order it now. It'll be pre-released. And, you know, the cover itself is pretty cool. So you should check that out if you haven't seen it. My friend drew it, and it's like, you know, you've got Falcor, you've got Gizmo on there, you've got,
you know. I love the fact that your name's on a VHS cassette. I was like, that's so cool.
I mean, it's all about the VHS.
So we'll put all your the links and stuff on our socials. And is there any social details people can get in contact with you or reach out to you if you want them to?
Absolutely. I'm on Instagram at Ems Marinelli, E-M-S Marinelli, M-A-R-I-N-E-L-L-I. And we could probably link that too. And you can absolutely hit me up there. You know, we can connect and you can get more information about the book and all of the events that are going to be coming up around the book this year.
Thank you so much. And thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. This is a blast.
Thank you.
Michael, that was great. I'm so pleased that you managed to catch up with Emily. That sounds like you had a great time chatting together.
They were lovely. I feel like they are going to be a big friend and family of the show from now on. I had a great time talking with
Absolutely.
them.
Absolutely. And I'm telling you, that Twin Peaks episode is happening. You can go on vacay and I'm going to get on with Emily and we're going to do a Twin Peaks deep dive.
Do I have to edit the interview afterwards?
Yes, because it will be 10 hours.
Excellent. Oh, geez.
10 hours of nerding out about Twin Peaks.
Oh, my God. So, guys, if you want to go and order Em's book, you can find the link on our link tree. I've added it there and straight to the publisher's page. So it'd be quick and easy, and go and pre-order it. I have. Claire has. We're going to get copies of it everywhere. So please go and pre-order a copy of the book. That would be amazing. So, Claire, what do you think about Mannequin 2?
In terms of how I found the movie generally, I had never seen it before prior to watching it for this. I have seen Mannequin before many, many, many times. I think most people our age have done those sort of early, mid, probably into late 40-year-olds. Because it was a huge movie from our childhood. It was, what, 1987, was it, the first one came out? So we were 7 years old. Again, it wouldn't have been one that I went to see at the movie theatre. I would have seen it on TV when it came onto TV. But it's the sort of movie that I think probably did get quite a lot of airplay on TV. But somehow the sequel passed me by. I guess maybe that didn't make it onto TV.
So I couldn't really find any figures about the film with the UK in mind, or even Europe, kind of like how well it performed or what the awareness of it overseas. So I'm not even sure if it even had a UK release.
Yeah, I knew it existed until quite recently.
I hadn't seen it either before recording the episode. So that was quite a fun thing to look at.
I really enjoyed rewatching the first movie, even though actually watching it now and objectively, I'm not sure it's a great movie, but it is, because it carries that nostalgia factor.
Yes.
And it's so light and it's so lovely and it's so innocent, and you just wouldn't get, like, if they did make that reboot, I think you would lose a lot of the heart of the movie, because they just don't make movies like that anymore, where it's just a very lovely, sweet love story.
Yeah.
That there's nothing more to it than that. There's no big, there is no big drama. I mean, there's barely even a bad guy in the first movie.
No.
It's such a lovely kind of sweet bit of fluff. And so with this one, they have kept a lot of the sweetness and the loveliness and the fluffiness. They have brought in the bad guy element, which it took me a little bit to get my head around having that factor, because it felt a bit sledgehammery. But it's switching on the Panto brain, isn't it? And going, okay, well, that's where we're at. This is Panto. Yeah. And then you can accept the mole hair stroking villain, and the big beefy Austrian gladiator-style henchmen, it's not even their voices in the movie. They got dubbed because they couldn't even say those basic lines properly.
Oh, Jesus.
It was that bad. So they had to have their lines were all dubbed, but, you know, they were hired to be big and smooth skinned and shiny and fill out their unitards. And that's exactly what they did, in a very Panto-y way. And so once I got my head around that, I kind of liked that aspect of it. Yeah, I think I like the performances in it. I think that it's very hammy. It's very cheesy, but it hits the right notes for me. They're taking it seriously enough. They're not taking the piss out of the movie with their performances. They're taking it seriously enough that it works. I love Meshach Taylor in this movie. I found it really interesting, actually, the conversation that you had with Emily about that performance.
Yeah.
Because I did flip between, is this offensive or is it brilliant?
Yeah.
And I think I come down on the side of it's brilliant, purely because representation was so low.
Yeah.
In the late 80s and early 90s. And yes, in an ideal world, we wouldn't be having a cishet male actor playing a big flamboyant, overtly gay character. But the fact that we have an overtly gay character in a movie in the late 80s and early 90s, and there is no doubt, it's not like there are other movies where you have your kind of your camp flamboyant queer-coded character, but they are not explicitly gay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case with Hollywood. He makes, I think it's in the first movie that he says, there's two things I like, kissing boys and winning fights or something, when he's about to hose down all the security guards. There's no, you know, they use some pretty offensive terminology to describe him in that first movie.
Yeah.
But
I agree.
He completely owns the badge. And I like that. And that's still the case in the second movie.
I prefer Hollywood in the sequel, not because of him. It's just that every time he appeared on screen in the first movie, some other extra or character within those scenes would make some comment about him being gay or him being flamboyant.
Absolutely.
In this film, that wasn't removed. He was on stage playing the character. The other characters didn't have to comment on his behavior. You know, I felt...
Yes.
I felt the film, this film was gayer than the original film.
Yes.
But and more camp, but less offensive with it.
Agreed.
Just because over the straight characters in the first film always had to make some gay, snarky comment at Hollywood. And they didn't do that at all in this film. What really, I was a bit like, here comes the gay comics. I was like, oh, there is none in this movie. That's really great. You can see the progression from 1987 to 1991, the way that a gay character like that was treated in on screen within this franchise.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. It was much better. I think there's a lot to like in this movie. The thing is, we're kind of leaning now into things that I didn't enjoy so much. It's very samey. The concept is the same. Adding in the idea of there being a villain doesn't really change the overall concept. I like that we get to see more of her in human mode than we do. You know, Kim Cattrall was a mannequin for too much of the first movie. There was
that
an awful
depends
lot.
Depends how you feel about Kim Cattrall, to be honest, doesn't it?
Well, this is true.
I think that probably Sarah Jessica Parker prefers the first one.
No, I think what I mean is it's nice to see Jesse able to interact with other characters.
Yes. Yeah.
Which obviously in the first movie, Emmy doesn't, until the very, very end, Emmy isn't able to interact with any of the other characters.
Yeah.
Whereas in this version, Jesse is able to interact with other characters besides just, what was the guy's name? Jason, the character?
Yes, Jason.
Yes, Jason. I forgot his first name. I remember his second name, Williamson, because they did a very subtle Williamson, because he is the descendant of Prince William. Thank you for the clue there, movie makers.
I remember it was Jason because he's bloody hot. I was like, oh, he was also in the actor was also in Fright Night, what I loved as a kid. There's Fright Night too. We should cover that sometime. But the guy who played Jason, when in the early 90s, I always thought he was quite cute.
He was beautiful.
He was hot. He was very hot.
Absolutely beautiful. Yeah, no question. As is Christy Swanson. They're a very beautiful couple. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I found it a little bit samey, and it felt more like a reboot than a sequel.
Yes.
I think. On misanthropy.com, Gordon Maples says, I think it's actually a pretty decent remake of the original movie, if not a good sequel. I think this movie primarily focuses on trying to fix issues with the first movie and reimagine the concept. And I think to an extent, I kind of agree with that. I think like I say, it by allowing Jesse to interact with more characters, I think it fleshes the movie out a little bit more. Because there's only so much you can do if your main character can only interact with one other character in the movie. It limits your options. By enabling her to interact with other characters and by introducing the notion that by putting the necklace onto other people, they can become enchanted in the same way, adds an extra kind of level of humor. I mean, I know they don't explore that extensively, but I guess they introduce it with Hollywood in order that they can then bring it in at the end. You know what's going to happen when she puts it on to the count at the end.
But why didn't, talking about the necklace, why didn't Prince William ever try taking that necklace off? If Jason was a descendant of him and her true love, why didn't...
Because the curse was, it was a true love from another land.
Oh, that makes sense.
I think was the wording of the curse. Do you know what? We had a conversation about the curse earlier today or yesterday, and I had forgotten that little bit of wording, which is why it sounds like I'm springing it on you now. I'd forgotten until you asked that question why it couldn't have been Prince William, was I think the curse was it had to be a true love from another land. Maybe that's why. So the reason that we had that conversation in the first place was you were saying, why doesn't the Count just take the necklace off her? And I said, well, because it has to be, unless the thousand years are up, which they're not. They kind of give the impression in the movie that the thousand years are up, but it's I don't think they are, because I think it's the opening scenes are from like the 1300s, and it's been like 600 years. So the thousand years is not up. So she can only be brought back to life by the true love. So maybe he's thinking if he takes the mannequin on tour, he will miraculously bump into a true love, which is exactly what happened. So I guess, he wanted, you know, the plan worked.
Kind of. He ended up pulling out of a hot air balloon.
Well, yes, but that was a nice little Disney death. I liked that.
It was very clean. Because
like a Disney death outside of Disney, they can't just push him out of the balloon. He can't die, because then they're not the good guys if they kill a guy.
Yeah.
But what they can do is turn him into a mannequin and then fling him down onto the street and have him run over by a trash collector.
Yeah. No, I get that. I get that. The first film was a compactor and now it was a trash collector. So it's kind of like both to deal with trash. Excellent. They went far with that.
Absolutely. See, it all links round. It all links round.
It does.
What about you? How did you feel about the movie?
There's things like you, things I liked and disliked. I see the flaws in it probably because there was too many writers on the project. When the names came up and I was like, oh, that's quite a lot of writers there. I'm in for a ride. Normally when scripts change hands so many times and the direction the script was going in the first place only veers off slightly because everybody wants to put their two pennies worth into it. There's too many writers on it. I thought Hollywood was great. I really liked him in this one. I think I preferred him in this one than the original. I really, really disliked the bad German accents. They made me cringe quite a lot.
Well, like I say, they were dubbed over, but I don't know by who.
But they
were dubbed over. They weren't even the guy.
He's actually annoying. It was terrible. I'm not sure how I feel about... I felt the Egyptian storyline in the original one worked better than the whole peasant girl and the princess bride kind of aspect of. And I think that's mainly because maybe we're British and we grew up with that as actual history and not, we didn't grow up with it as kind of like, because like Egyptian stuff was slightly more fairy tale like than our historical stuff. So when I watch back historical things in that period of time and there's a bunch of people with an American accent, so I think I'd go, my biggest thing with this movie, and Emily touched on it with me when I spoke to them, the store was underused. I really liked in the first film, the store was a part of the movie. It had its own personality. Absolutely. And I felt like it was just background fodder for this film. I thought like that it was a waste of them being there. And I thought, why don't they base it in a museum or change it to a different mall, like do a Las Vegas mall? You have a historical.
Yeah, I agree. We had this conversation as well, didn't we? And obviously you had it with Emily in your chat with them. It is weird that it's still in the department store. And what Emily said about the psychology behind it and the comfort element absolutely makes sense. I get that. And it makes more sense now that I've heard that conversation. Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Because the mannequin was on the move.
Yeah.
Do you see?
I do, but like, I just felt like we use Greece too as a point of reference for that, for when I spoke to Emily. But Rydell High is as big a part as Greece too, as it is in Greece. Some aspects would say more because they put on the shows and stuff in there, and there's less time away from the school in Greece too. While in this movie, I feel like it's not playing the character it played in the first film. And that's what I really...
Sure. It could have been anywhere.
Yeah,
and because all of the staff at the store have changed as well, with the exception of Hollywood and this security guard that may or may not be the same person from the first movie, the location then becomes the only bit of continuity. And as you say, if you're not using the location, you're not getting those reminders. Even the bits that were set in the store didn't use those big long shots.
Yeah, exactly.
Like we had in the first movie of Kim Cattrall hang gliding around the store. And they went round on a bike, didn't they? And I guess because the concept of the movie was that she couldn't be anywhere else. She could only be with him. They didn't go anywhere.
But they could have got the actress back to play the shop owner again, the Golden Girl. Who played You know, I think that would have been nice if she came back for a small cameo.
Estelle Getty.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. I was thinking, is that the right Golden Girl or is that a different Golden Girl?
No, that's the right Golden Girl. It's the only one I don't know their name. I know the other three. So, but I think my main, like, that's one of my main issues. But my problem with this film is, and you can tell that, like what you said, the script and story was written before, just straight after the first film. Because rom-coms changed quite a lot during that short period of time. Now, so the first film came out in 1987. Just after the first movie came out, about four or five months later, we had Dirty Dancing come out. What kind of changed the whole comedy and romance movie.
Yeah.
In 1990, a year before this movie came out, Mannequin 2, we had Pretty Woman. The biggest home release of all time. It was huge in the cinema. It was a cultural impact on female movies within the cinema. And I think people were just a bit tired of the damsel in distress kind of stuff by that point when it came to rom-coms. Even though at the end of this, Jessie's character is not really that damsel in distress because she puts a necklace on the count and she's the one who throws him over. So but when people saw the poster and saw that it was coming out, they probably went, oh, it's going to be the same old hashtag, woman, girl in distress. What probably put a lot of female audiences going off to watch it. But by then, they're like, well, why don't you do that? I can go and rent Pretty Woman and have a much better time for the 16th time I've watched that movie. Because, you know, Julia Roberts' character in that is not a damsel in distress. The man goes begging for her. You know, she is a powerful character. And I feel like...
Absolutely.
And I think movies have just moved on quite a lot. But saying that, I would like to see a remake of Mannequin, but maybe with a male mannequin. Mm-hmm. And maybe with a female window dresser or even a male window dresser and do like a little gay twist on the storyline. Or maybe a male mannequin that wakes up for two people, the female window dresser and the male window dresser.
A love triangle. Can you imagine?
That'd be fun, wouldn't it?
Can you? I mean, it does still sound like a porno, even when you say it like that.
Well, yeah, if anybody's doing stuff with a plastic doll and gets caught like that all the time, there's no getting away from it. But I would like to see it, or even kind of like, I think if the world was streaming now, we could get a good TV movie out of it. You know?
Yes, but not as a hologram.
I think you should keep it as a mannequin. So, Claire, how many mannequins would you give Mannequin 2 on the move?
Well, funnily enough, you saying that on Rotten Tomatoes, the audience score was 40% is what you said, wasn't it?
Yep.
I have scored this movie 2 out of 5. Oh. So bang on, exactly the same as them. I think it's a very watchable movie. I just don't think it's a particularly good sequel. I don't think I don't think it does enough with the original concept.
Yeah.
In terms of developing it into something sequel worthy, I think it is more of a reworking and a reboot of the original than it is a continuation.
Yeah.
We do have a very brief reference from Hollywood to the fact that this has happened before.
Yeah.
But other than that, it doesn't really feel like a continuation of what was established in the first movie. It just feels like another version of the same thing to me.
Yeah.
So I find it almost as watchable. And in some ways, like you say, Hollywood is a much better character and the way people relate to Hollywood in this movie is much better than in the first. Generally, I think I would choose the first one over this one.
Yes.
But I could very happily just sit and watch it and let it wash over me with no problem at all. How about you?
So I would give it 2.5 out of 5. There's nothing offensive about it. It's quite an easy watch. You can let it go over your head. The cast is great. I just feel like the storyline is lacking. It is, like Emily says, a comfort sequel. It's very comforting to watch. You know where it's going. You know what it's doing. You've seen the first film. Like, the first film, I think, is a fantastic rom-com. Like, it's 4 out of 5. No matter how many times I've watched that movie, I've loved it. You know, I hardly see any fault with the original movie apart from the gay insults. But that was the period of time we lived in, because they felt like if they've got to have an open gay person on screen, they've got to be the straight counterpart.
They've got to balance it out with some casual homophobia.
Yeah, exactly.
Welcome to the 80s.
Welcome to the 80s. No? Okay, Claire's looking at me like I'm nuts. Okay. No? Okay, but Hairspray realtered from this movie. So yeah, so I would like to see, I would give it 2.5 out of 5. I'm a massive fan of the original. I felt like this was missing something, but I still had fun. You know, it didn't hurt me. It didn't kill me. 50%, you know, if you're a hardcore fan, you probably won't like this. But if you're just there for a good old Sunday afternoon, there's probably less offensive things in this one. You can probably have this on with the kids in the background playing, doing something. There's nothing wrong with the movie compared to the first one, where it gets a little bit saucy at times when the guy in it's always found naked. Doing stuff. So this one, he's kind of, it's a bit more cleaner.
Got to keep the mums happy and some of the dads.
Some of the dads, exactly. So, yeah. But if any, they really want to do something with this one, not a Mannequin 2, if they really want to go and do something with the Mannequin franchise, give me a musical. Easy for Broadway.
Yeah.
Easy for the West End. A musical with Mannequin would work. So, well, get Kim Cattrall in as the store owner. She would do
yes.
it. We want musical on Mannequin. That would be great.
She might do it. That Netflix thing hasn't done too well, has it?
It's been cancelled.
Which I'm sad about. I quite liked it.
Yeah, it was fodder. It was fun. It was just background TV. It was entertaining.
Anyway, but no more.
No more.
So that's Mannequin 2 on the Move for you. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of the movie. You can leave us a comment. You can email us on unlovedsequels@gmail.com. And you can find us on all the socials at unlovedsequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And from me, Claire.
Take care, guys. Bye.
Oh, me, oh, my. I'm in love with you, baby.